Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to Made by Mamas, the podcast. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Georgia.
And we're here talking all things parenthood. You know, the real conversations.
Tips and tricks.
Products we love.
And brands we can't live without.
Let's get into it.
So it feels like we've been bouncing from illness to illness recently. Obviously, we've been talking about it a lot on our socials. Chickenpox in our house, colds, flu, the lot. We've also heard from you that you've been feeling the same. Lots of little ones under the weather. So we thought we would get an expert on to answer all of your questions. We are so excited to be joined by paediatrician Dr. Kieran Rahim, also known as the munching medic. I love that. Welcome. How are you?
Hello. Morning. Oh, thank you for having me.
If you wouldn't mind, would you just tell us a little bit about you and what you do and your experience and stuff? We've had so many questions and we are going to have to get into them pretty quick, but it would be great to just find out a little bit about you first.
Yeah, absolutely. So hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. So my name's Kieran. I am a paediatrician, which means I'm a children's doctor. So I deal with children right from like the minute they're day zero, premature babies, up until they're 18. I work in London, but that's probably a very small part of who I am. My main role in life is motherhood. So I'm mum to three little ones.
And she's got a little one right here with us now who she's nursing intermittently and trying to juggle everything. It's just incredible.
Quite literally. So she's the reason I'm on maternity leave at present. So I have two boys and a little girl. And then I also use my social platform to engage with parents and sort of help them navigate motherhood, which I know in the lockdown was quite needed, because I know lots of people struggle to access sort of the services that they could have accessed pre-pandemic, which, you know, is a shame. And then trying to find our feet after that all of the last 2 years has been quite challenging, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it can be really difficult, especially when your children are not feeling very well or, you know, they're sick. Mm-hmm. It's kind of finding that balance, isn't it, between thinking, oh, they'll be fine. I don't want to bother the GP because they're already strained. They're already under lots of pressure. But then also sometimes your maternal instinct kicks in and you think, no, like there's something wrong here. And it can feel, especially now, like a lot of the appointments that we have are over the phone first, and it mm-hmm. takes a while to actually get seen. You really have to like bash down doors if you feel like there is something really wrong. So that's why we're so happy to have this, because obviously some of these questions will probably be super easy for you to answer, and we know we're in good hands. So
right, George, I think it's time we get into the questions. We've got loads in there.
Yeah, let's crack on.
First, it's really important to say this as well. This episode is for advice only and shouldn't replace going to see your GP, okay?
This is interesting, and I think this definitely happens with Axel, my son. Why does my child always get rashes when they're run down?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, and reassuringly, it's just the body's reaction to often having like a fever or a cold. So we call it a viral xanthem, and often that rash is quite blotchy looking. It appears all over the place, and the reassuring thing is it goes away when you press it. And it's just the body's way of dealing with it. We actually don't know why it happens. We think it's linked to the way your immune system reacts. So as you all know, we all have a different immune system, and some of us get hives when we're unwell. the rest of us don't. So as long as the rash appears and you can, when you press it, it fades away, that's reassuring. If it's quite like a blanchy, sort of quite flat rash, that's also reassuring. It's more like the pinprick rashes that we worry about. And if you're having the rashes when they're not, when they're well, that's also something to consider having looked at. But actually, a rash that comes with fever is really, really reassuring.
Brilliant. Okay, let's go on to this one now. 18-month-old child is below the 0.4th centile for height. Very short. Should we be worried?
So in short, the answer is no. I always say to parents, you know, children come in all shapes and sizes, which is really interesting because when they're really little, we obsess over their height and weight. Mm. But if you look at the adult population, we also come in all shapes and sizes. So you have short adults, you have tall adults, you have adults that weigh different amounts. And what's more important that you is that your child is tracking along their centile. And I say this as a mum, I know how hard it is to have a small child. My eldest was also on the 0.4th centile, and it wasn't until he was like six that he moved up to the 9th centile. So still quite small. Whereas my second and my third are tracking between the 50th and the 99th centile. So, you know, even in my own family, I've got three different things. What's important is A, your baby or your toddler is putting on weight. You know, it doesn't have to be tons of weight, but as long as they're growing, that's reassuring. Also that they are healthy in themselves, so they don't have things like chronic diarrhea. You know, they're not losing weights or massive amounts of weight. They're happy and healthy, and they're meeting their milestones. So those things are far more important than what their height and weight are doing. When you get to about 3 or 4 and you're still really worried, you can ask your GP to refer you to a dietitian or your pediatrician. But for most people, that isn't necessary. Your child's height is somewhere between your height and your partner's height. So for example, if both of you are quite small, you're not going to produce a 6'10" adult. And I say this because I'm 5'2" as an adult, so I'm quite small. And my husband is 6'3". So our children will be somewhere between that, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So your mid-parental height is what you're aiming for.
Because our daughter, Gigi, I didn't realise, I think probably because of the pandemic as well, I didn't realise how small she is until she got her preschool uniform and I bought the smallest polo shirt that I could.
Sure.
And it's literally at her ankles.
Oh, yeah. Bless her.
And then she sort of goes in and I'm like, wow, how old are those children? They're like, oh, they're 2. And I think, oh my goodness, she's so small. But then like you say, I'm 5'3". My husband's probably what, 5'10", maybe 5'9". Yeah. So we're both small people, so we're probably not going to produce giant children.
Absolutely.
But it did worry me at first. I suddenly like, oh my goodness, like should I be doing something here? Should I go and see somebody? But obviously not.
I think also it's really hard because as parents, you're bombarded with like images of really chubby babies and chubby toddlers. And so you think that's the norm. But actually, remember, centiles from 0 to 99 is an idea that in 100 children, that's where your kid lies. So some children will be smaller, some children will be bigger, and some of them don't even make the charts because they are so small. What's more important is that they're growing and thriving. And if those two things aren't happening, then absolutely, you know, you must get some help.
See somebody. Toddler had loose bowels for a couple of weeks post chicken pox.
Yep.
Is that normal?
Yes. So loose stools after a viral illness, which is what chicken pox is really normal. So as you know, I mean, as people that follow me know, I often talk about your microbiome. So these are all the healthy bacteria that live in your gut that make it really good for your health, and they keep you happy. And we, you know, there's a reason we say happy gut, happy mind. So when you have an illness, sometimes all of that bacteria can disappear, or you can develop what we call a lactose intolerance.
Yeah.
So sometimes you lose all the enzymes that are in the gut after a viral illness. So whenever you have things like milk, you don't necessarily have those enzymes to help you process it because you've lost them. So that's why even in adults, you may notice that once you've been quite poorly, your bowels are quite like soft and runny after a viral illness, because it takes a little while for your gut to recover. And that's very similar in children. So they can develop what we call a transient lactose intolerance. But if it's just the one or two episodes that last for a few weeks, I wouldn't worry. Like, as long as they're putting on weight and the bowels return to their normal habit, then that's reassuring.
God, that's so interesting. I never thought of that. So if your child has had like a virus or something, should you be giving them a probiotic or something to try and like help the gut or not?
You can do if they've got that change. I think probiotics have their place. I would definitely consider them if your child's been on antibiotics, because what antibiotics do is they wipe out all bacteria, so good and bad. So,
right.
You know, that's why children also get that diarrhea with antibiotics as well, and afterwards as well. And I personally do give my children probiotics and prebiotics when they're poorly.
And which ones would you recommend?
So you can get loads. So I used to give them the bio cult ones, which when they had the baby and the child ones, they no longer do those. There's BioGaia you can use, which is quite good, but essentially anything that is cheap and chirpy. There's no one brand, in my personal opinion, that is better than ever.
Perfect. God, that's so interesting.
Yeah, it really is, G. So we've just touched on chickenpox, so let's go on to the chickenpox chat. There's been so much of it around recently. I feel like every time I go on social media, somebody else that I know, their child has got chickenpox. So firstly, Grace has asked for the pros and cons of the chickenpox vaccine. I'm so interested to hear this.
Yeah, so chickenpox is one of those topics. Whenever I do a Q&A, it comes up again and again. I actually have a really detailed post on my page. So as a pediatrician, if someone asks me, should I get my child vaccinated, I always tell them to weigh up the balance, weigh it up for their own personal circumstances. So if your child gets chickenpox, roughly we're looking at between a week to 2 weeks off school, which means parents need to take that much time off work if you haven't got childcare. So you need to factor in childcare costs. The pros for me are that they can get vaccinated from the age of one. Relatively, if they do get chickenpox, it's a very, very, very mild illness. There's no scarring. The chances of complications are really, really low. The cons are, for me, the only con is that there is some debate amongst medics and in the literature about whether it increases the rate of shingles in adults. So that's why most people think, oh, I shouldn't get chickenpox. But actually, chickenpox vaccination is part of the schedule in many developed countries. So if you look at US, if you look at Canada, if you look at France, they have it as part of their national program.
Right.
And for us in the NHS, it's very much a cost thing. Unfortunately, we don't have endless funds, whereas in those countries, they often have like a private system that sort of funds the healthcare system. So it is very much a cost thing. And shingles for the NHS is very, very expensive to treat. So the idea that I think behind it is that if everyone gets vaccinated, then perhaps shingles will increase. We don't have that. We don't have evidence of that from other countries. So for example, there hasn't been an increase in, say, the US or Canada, where they've been vaccinating for years. And I think it's really important to remember that even if you get chickenpox, one in four people will get shingles as adults. So it's not like there isn't a background risk anyway. Now, full disclosure, my children are vaccinated and my baby will be vaccinated by the time she gets to 18 months, because I personally think it's worth doing. It's saving time off school. I have quite significant scarring from when I had chickenpox. I had it quite late. I didn't get it until my secondary school.
Right.
So I remember being like 13 and having like really bad chickenpox on my face, and and it's really hard not to pick at it. You're a teenager. And now I have like lots of scarring on my cheeks, which is, for me, I know I don't want that for my kids, as vain as that sounds, but it's just something I don't want to put them through. And it's a really miserable illness. Now, the other side of that is that actually it is a relatively common childhood illness. Lots of people get it, and most children are fine with it. There are a few children that can develop like the complications, which are like, getting a really bad chest infection and occasionally infection that can affect your brain. And we call it encephalitis. So it's rolling the dice and praying that your child doesn't get the complications, which most children don't. You know, most children are fine with it. They get poorly and they're back on their feet within sort of 7 to 10 days. But it's whether you can afford those 7 to 10 days off work.
Yeah, of course.
So you have to balance those costs up as well.
I'm not sure if my son's had chickenpox or not, which is such a weird thing, because he had, what we thought was really bad hand, foot and mouth when he was like, I must have been 18 months old, but it was everywhere. It was all over his face, all like absolutely everywhere. And the doctor at the time said, oh, it's hand, foot and mouth. And then I went for like maybe his 2-year check. And they said to me, oh, what's all those marks on his legs? And I said, oh, he had hand, foot and mouth. And they said, oh no, that looks like chicken pox. But I now think, now he's almost 6 and at school, I think, should I get him the vaccine? Or would it do any harm, basically, if he's already had it, if I gave it to him?
No, not at all. Yeah, no. I mean, so you're not allowed to have the vaccine if you've had exposure in say, the last 2 to 3 weeks. No vaccine. But after that, if there's uncertainty, then absolutely you can get them vaccinated. In your child's case, it probably was chickenpox, because hand, foot and mouth tends not to leave marks like that. And did he have any on his hand, the soles of his hands and palms?
No.
Yeah, so unlikely to be hand, foot and mouth.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess I didn't see any sort of, I think I only spoke to the doctor over the phone or like a video call or something. And so it was all, and I was at home with him anyway. So it wasn't like, I don't know, it was all fine at the time. But now he's sort of been around people who've had chickenpox and not caught it. I'm like, oh.
He's probably immune then, yeah.
But I made it with my daughter.
Okay, next one. Someone has said here, my 2-week-old caught chickenpox and was treated with antivirals. Can he catch it again? And does it stop him building up his own immunity? Wow, do you know what? I've never heard of that before.
No, so that's really interesting. So obviously, as you know, newborns don't necessarily have the same level of protection as we do. And in terms of their brain, so the reason we treat them with antivirals is to protect their brain, essentially. So they don't have what we call the blood-brain barrier, which stops the rest of us getting, every time we get infection, it going to our brain. So antivirals is our choice. So any newborn, so anyone under the age of 4 weeks is generally treated with antivirals. Whether he catches it again or not, I can't answer, because I don't know how bad it was. But generally speaking, if they've had exposure once, they shouldn't catch chickenpox again. The antivirals won't stop him building his immunity. It's just to ensure that he had or she had the antibodies that we would have given in the antivirals to fight the infection.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
And stop the complications, because actually children under 6 months that get chickenpox are more likely to have sort of those complications like pneumonia and encephalitis. So it was more a protective thing rather than a stopping them getting it.
Both my kids complain of stomach pain so often. Should I worry?
Honestly, if I got a penny for the amount of times I get asked about tummy pain, I'd be a very, very rich woman. I'm probably not working in the NHS. There we go. So in most children, by far and large, stomach pain is related to constipation. So I would ask you to look at your child's bowel habits. So children complain of tummy pain often, and more often than not, it is constipation. They don't necessarily eat a large variety of foods and fruits and fiber. And most children, in my experience, are constipated. So how often is your child pooing? Is it every day? Is it every other day? Is it soft? Is it hard? Are they straining when it comes out? That kind of detail is what you want to look into. Is it related to behavioral things as well? So often you might notice a pattern. So if they're anxious, they may complain of tummy ache. If something's going on at school, they may complain of tummy ache. So it's finding out whether it's like a psychosocial or behavioral thing, or whether it's related to, you know, things like constipation. A really good way for parents to test to see how constipated or not constipated their kids are is to give them a spoonful of sweet corn. So give them in the morning, and then you want to look at their poo when it comes out. So if it's coming out within sort of 24 hours, unlikely to be constipation. But if that sweet corn is coming out 2 or 3 days later, it is likely to be constipation, and you need to see your pharmacist or your GP to get some laxatives on board. Constipation is a tough one to treat in children.
That is so interesting. Thank you. There's one come up here about why are doctors so reluctant to give antibiotics to children? Sometimes they're really suffering and they don't give them out.
That's a really interesting. We are really anti. So I'm really anti-antibiotics and I own up to that. And the reason for that is because we know the majority of infections in little ones are viral. So it means they're caused by different viruses. I can honestly, if I could sit here and name you probably 40 viruses off the top of my head. And so it's usually a viral illness one after the other. Antibiotics are reserved for bacterial illnesses. And the reason we don't give them to children is I talked about that microbiome. It completely wipes it out. Children also have side effects to antibiotics. So it's not like they don't come without the diarrhea or they may get a rash. And actually, we know from literature that children that are given antibiotics are perhaps only, they only get better one day before those that aren't given antibiotics. And so you have to balance that with giving lots of people or children antibiotics and they're being resistant. So we know we now are in that stage, globally, where we are developing resistance to the common antibiotics we're using, which means that we need to find new antibiotics, which means that we're creating things called superbugs.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we don't want to be in a situation in 30, 40 years' time where we've given out so many antibiotics, we've got all these superbugs going around that we don't have antibiotics for. So we really do keep them for really severe infections or where we think there is a bacterial infection, which in children is not that common. And majority of them do have viral infections.
That's so interesting because I think when I was young, I used to have antibiotics all the time. Like, yeah. I mean, anything. I remember like that, the little medicine, like the yellow medicine. Whereas my son's six now and he's never had antibiotics. Yeah. And I mean, it's great. It's obviously a great thing and he's got through it. But I think how many times had I had it by the time I was six? Probably, five or six times, probably something like that. I guess we're learning now as well, aren't we?
That's exactly it. So, as science moves along, we know that actually overuse of antibiotics isn't great and that we do prescribe them more often than we should. And I agree with you, my children have never really had antibiotics either and I'd like to keep it that way. And I probably had antibiotics quite recently for it. I developed a pneumonia, chest infection. And that was after maybe 15 or 20 years I've had to have a course of antibiotics. And I was very upset because I was like, oh, all of that gut health that I've built up is now gone.
So if your child is prescribed antibiotics, doctor, would you suggest that they then take that probiotic straight away?
Yeah, I personally would. And I know I take it. So I take Biocult, which is the one I take regularly. Yeah. And I love it because I can sprinkle it on stuff. So I did take it as I was taking antibiotics. And so you just need to find whichever one suits you. But I personally would take something like that if you're on antibiotics.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to this episode of Made by Mamas. Now, where were we?
Kelly has said, my little one has a nocturnal cough. It's just every night, but not in the day. Is that is that an allergy?
Unlikely. So I don't know how old Kelly's little one is, but if they are preschoolers or say in their primary school, the first thing I think about a nocturnal cough is asthma, because that's sort of the hallmark sign of asthma. I would keep a diary of when the cough comes, how bad it is. Allergy coughs tend to be during the day. So allergy, so the peak pollen times is around 7 to 9 o'clock in the morning and then 5 to 7 o'clock in the evening. So you may notice, like, for example, your hay fever or your allergies are worse at that time. So that's when that tends to happen. And allergy coughs aren't all year round. So they tend to be more common between sort of March and September, and they ease off in winter. Now, if alongside the nocturnal cough, you've got things like exercise induced coughing. So if your child's running around and then they cough after they've been running around for a while, that also points to something like asthma. I would encourage you to book a non-urgent appointment with your GP to discuss the nocturnal cough, because and then keep a diary by the time you get that appointment. So what's happening, when it's happening, and does anything make it worse or better?
Oh, that's so interesting.
My daughter's a bit like that. Actually, someone else here has said that my child's always got a runny nose. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I don't know the ages. So children underneath the age of, say, you know, 4 or 5, they can have up to 10 illnesses a year. And they tend to be concentrated between sort of like this, the autumn and the winter months. So if you think about it, and each illness lasts between 5 to 7 days. Now, when you first start school, you're mixing, like nursery, you're mixing with other kids, you're bringing all these viruses home, and they do just cause what we call coryzal symptoms. It isn't uncommon. You know, like they'll have like an illness for a week and a bit, then they'll get better for a few days, and then they'll pick up the next virus. Now, just remember, they're building their immune system, they're building their immunity. So by the time they get to like 7 or 8, they'll be fine in majority of cases. If your child is having them worse in the summer, then think about things like hay fever and allergies, like pollen allergies and stuff, because it may well be that.
Right. Okay. There's quite a few messages here around tonsils, but this one's from Lucy. My little one has ongoing breathing, eating and snoring issues with enlarged tonsils. She's nearly 3 years old. Will they remove them?
Yes, they should. If it's causing snoring and if it's causing sleep issues, then yes. So Lucy, I think it's really important you go to your GP, perhaps take a video of the snoring episodes, how long they last for, whether she's tired during the day as well, because sometimes snoring can be a sign of obstructive sleep apnea, which means children, the tonsils aren't letting them breathe on time, breathe properly, and actually it can impede their growth. So as long keep an eye on her growth as well, but I would definitely go back to your GP and actually be referred to an ENT specialist, because that needs looking into.
Perfect. Wow, my 1-year-old can sleep 15 hours at night and a 2-hour nap in the day. She's full of beans. I can't ask my mates if it's normal, because it feels very smug. That really makes me laugh, because I'd feel like, what, 15 hours at night and 2 hours in the day? But she's one.
Oh, that's amazing.
I mean, so can you have my baby? Maybe I don't know what you've done. That sounds amazing. No, honestly, I know. Don't feel smug. You're just lucky. And there's nothing, you know, my second child was like that. He slept for, like, he just took himself up to bed. I didn't have to do anything. And he would sleep from 6:30 in the evening till about 8-9 o'clock in the morning if I didn't wake him up, and then have a nap between. So as long as she's probably just tiring herself out, as long as she's happy, healthy, growing, I wouldn't worry. Enjoy it.
Oh my God, don't worry about it. Just enjoy it. That sounds amazing. Lucy has said, why does my 3-year-old wake up unhappy most mornings, even after a good sleep? This one I'm fascinated to hear.
Oh, that's interesting. So I wonder if they're having night terrors in the night, because it's not uncommon around that age for night terrors to begin. And then I don't know if they're sleeping by themselves or if they're scared. So you need to think about things like night lights, or whether they're waking up in the middle of the night wanting you. Do you know what I'm saying? Whether there's like an attachment issue going on there. It's probably just a phase that will pass, but I've not come across like any pathologies that would cause it. Does that make sense? It's probably just like they're seeking reassurance and may benefit from someone being around them when they wake up rather than waking up alone.
Yeah, I sometimes find my son, Axel, I've said, is nearly six. He seems sometimes to have, like, I don't know, 13 hours sleep at night, and he wakes up tired. But when I've shared a bed with him, he scratches a lot and, like, moves around so much. And I think, what is going on? You're almost having, like, a fight in the night. No wonder you're waking up tired. Like, yeah. What causes that kind of, like, restless sleep?
So it can be a whole bunch of things. So with the itching, has he got eczema?
He had it when he was a baby. Mm. And then as soon as he stopped having milk, it completely went away.
Yeah, so I would just have his skin looked at then, just because if that itching is waking him up enough, because you shouldn't really itch at night, like the rest of, you know, then it makes me wonder if there's something else going on. So, you know, it's the same thing like we had with that cough. If something is waking children up from their sleep and doing it regularly and stopping them having a good night's rest, it's worth discussing it with either like your GP or your pharmacist, or if you have access to a pediatrician, doing that, because they should really be getting restful sleep. And if it's not something like sleep terrors that wake them up because they've had a dream, health shouldn't be causing them to wake up. So that itching I would get looked into, the snoring I would get looked into, the cough I would get looked into, because they should, you know, children should just go to sleep. You know, I'm a huge advocate for attachment parenting. And, you know, as adults, we don't like sleeping alone. I know I really sleep poorly when my husband's not around, because I'm just like, what the hell do I do with this massive bed? And children are very much the same. So I have a 9-year-old, a 5-year-old, and my 9-month-old. And it's not uncommon for all of them to end up in my bed. I mean, they'll sleep in their bed up until about 5-6 o'clock in the morning. But then after that, they're all in there with us.
Yeah.
And sometimes it happens more than others, you know, when they've had a nightmare. And I think that's just part and parcel of parenting, isn't it? They're just trying to go with the flow rather than reading all those books that tell us, no, they should be in their cribs and cots at like 6 o'clock, and then they should sleep through the night until 6-7 a.m. And if they're not doing that, there's something wrong with you and your child. That's absolute nonsense.
Do you know what? That is so interesting, because I've actually always been like that. Like, I've wanted them in their own bed, you know, as soon as possible, in their own room as soon as possible. I've always thought, you know, it's much better that they're not distracted by, or like disturbed by me, or like, you know, yep, woken up or whatever. But recently,
this is my favorite story, G.
But actually, this is a good example. At the weekend, we went out, we went to a party, we got home quite late, and they asked me if they could sleep in bed with me. And I was like, yeah, actually, of course you can. So I put them in my bed, and then I realized my husband would be coming home as well, and there'll be four of us, and there wouldn't be room. So I messaged him and said, the kids are in our bed together. I'm going to go and sleep in Axel's room because he's got a double bed. So that's what we did. And then by the morning, my husband was in bed with my son and I was in bed with my daughter. And we all woke up at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And we have never slept that well. Ever. Yeah. And I started to think, like, oh gosh, maybe they want to share a room, or maybe they want to sleep with, you know, when they sleep with each other, in bed with each other, they sleep so much better. It doesn't even necessarily have to be like me or, you know, my husband.
Yeah, absolutely.
I used to be so against it. Like, it has to be silent. It has to be pitch black. It has to be this temperature. That's the only way. And now I'm sort of coming round to thinking.
And you know, that's not your fault, because that's what we're told, isn't it, from the get-go, that children need to be in their own room from like day dot. And actually now we know from research and sort of stuff coming out that children should sleep in their parents' room at least up until the age of 1 year. And that's protective against SID you know, it helps build that sort of secure attachment. And I co-sleep with my little one. So she has, I want to say she has the snooze pod right next to me. She's very rarely in that snooze pod anymore, because now she'll crawl right in between my husband and I. And so now we don't even bother, because that's where she likes to sleep. And, you know, it's the same with my older two. Sometimes they just want to sleep with us. And like you say, I'll go into bed with one of them and my husband will sleep with the other one. The baby's obviously always with me because I'm still breastfeeding. And they sleep much, much better. So I would, you know, this little kid that's perhaps crying, maybe trial a few nights if you can. sleeping with them to see if that sort of takes that edge off.
It makes a difference. Yeah, it's so interesting. It's funny because me and Zoe, if we go back to listen to the podcast, like over the years that we've been doing it, we've always been like, no, we're not into co-sleeping. No, never going to do it. And now suddenly, I don't know as well if it's because our youngest children are getting a bit older and yeah. Neither of us have got plans to have any more children. We're suddenly like, oh, have we missed out on the co-sleeping? Come on, come into our bed.
But you know, do you not remember sleeping with your own parents? I remember like just being like coming home from school sometimes and just being like, I want to sleep with you, mum. And
yes,
and I think I was up, you know, like if I have that memory, I'm thinking I'm 8, maybe not.
Yeah, me, do you know, I was just thinking exactly the same. I remember it so well. My dad, I used to start off in bed with my dad because he'd always want to go to bed early. And then by the morning, my dad would be in my bed and my mum would be with me. Yeah, I remember it so well. Yes. Oh, gosh, don't.
Well, I've been doing that too. And you know what? I love that you and me are both doing this, George. Okay, we've had quite a few questions around iron deficiency in children. What do we look out for? How do we know if our child is not getting enough iron?
I mean, to be honest, that's an uncommon thing to come across. So iron deficiency is normally caused by too much milk. So children that are drinking too much cow's milk in particular, they tend to have low iron level. So remember, after the age of 1 year, your child doesn't need more than, you know, two to three helpings of dairy, which doesn't all need to be milk. So it can be one glass of milk and the cheese or yogurt. And so too much milk is the leading cause in most toddlers of iron deficiency and also constipation, because that's what it does. So if you think your child has got iron deficiency, you need to speak to a pediatrician, and you can get vitamins. We tend not to have iron vitamins because obviously you can also easily go the other way and have too much iron.
Yeah.
But it's all about introducing sort of iron rich foods. So, you know, if your child isn't a vegetarian, then things like meat are a great, so chicken, egg, minced meat, these are all sources of iron, broccoli, and other greeny leafy vegetables.
We haven't even got through all of the questions, so I'm just going to finish up maybe with just one more.
Yeah.
This lady is awaiting a pediatric appointment for blood in their 5 months old stools. What could it be?
Okay, so it could be a whole bunch of things. I don't know the background to that. It could be blood, it could not be blood. So I don't know if they've been to A&E and already been seen and then they've been referred to pediatrics. If it's an ongoing issue, then I would call the secretaries to chase it. I mean, the common things like cow's milk protein allergy is a common one for babies, that sometimes they get like blood or streaks in their poo. It could be, you know, hemorrhoids, or like the baby is constipated. Without knowing much more, I can't give a diagnosis, because it could be literally a whole bunch of things, and I don't want to scare you or, you know, or give information that isn't accurate. But if you are worried, I would call the secretaries. If it's getting worse, I would definitely think about it. If your baby's poorly with it, you don't need to wait, you know, go and see your doctor in A&E or go and see a GP. If it's an emergency and it's really bad, and your child looks poorly, then
then go
help.
And see someone at all.
And just to finish up, what are a couple of things that you should never ignore if you notice certain symptoms in your child? We obviously mentioned, you know, a rash that doesn't disappear when you press it. Is there anything else where we should just get professional help straight away when our parental instinct is telling us to do so?
I mean, the biggest thing is, and it's what you said, is about trusting your parental instinct. And I always say this to parents, like, ultimately, I only see your baby or your toddler for a really small time, and they may be completely well in that small time, but actually you are the expert in your child, nobody else. So if your parental instinct is zinging and saying, you know what, something isn't right here, absolutely I want to see you. And even if it is for reassurance, and I say, actually, you know what, thank you for bringing them in, I've had a look, I can't identify anything, your baby looks well, that's fine. I would much rather see reassure and send away than the other way, where your instinct is going off and something is really wrong, but you haven't sought help. So the first thing is always trust your parental instinct. And I say this as a mum at first. The second thing, you know, there are things that you can't ignore. So if your baby is under the age of 3 months and they have a fever at any point, you are not there to diagnose your baby. So babies under 3 months are very, very susceptible to getting very, very sick. So you don't go anywhere but A&E. You bring that baby to A&E, you get to see someone like me and we'll have a look at baby. If your child has a fever that lasts for day five or more, absolutely bring them in. So that's 5 consecutive days of fever. If your child's like constantly vomiting or has diarrheal illness and they're really not keeping their food down. So dehydration in babies happens quite quickly. So if they're not passing wet nappies or they're having less than 50% of their feeds, you should bring them in. Any abnormal movements that you haven't noticed before that are quite concerning, you're worried about, bring them in. Also things like breathing problems, if they're not breathing right or they're pausing or they just don't look right. And sometimes it is very much that there's something that you can't put your finger on, but it's your parental like spidey sense going, isn't it? That yeah. Something's not quite right. So if that is the case, absolutely. And we are part of your village and I know at the moment it doesn't seem that way because there are so many cuts to services and parents are waiting months and months and often years to get appointment. But that isn't our fault. As a general population, we're more than happy to see you, reassure you and send you on your way than the other way around. So trust yourself.
Yep. Do you know what? That's our motto as well. Always, always follow your gut. And, you know, it's just really good to hear you saying that, you know, you agree with that as well. And that's exactly what we should do. So thank you.
No, my pleasure. Can I just say that it's really hard at the moment being a parent. You don't have access to things, but, you know, health visitors are still doing their jobs. And if you're concerned about baby or toddler's development, your health visitor can help. In those early days, it's your midwife and your GP. If you are really worried, if there's something chronic that's going on that you've been multiple times to your GP, you can ask to be referred to a paediatrician. It may take a while, but there are avenues. And if you're very concerned about what to do and who to access health, you can always reach out. I'm more than happy to guide people to where they need to go.
Dr. Kieran for PM, thank you so I've heard there's a vacancy. Thank you so much. You were absolutely amazing.
Jill, that was so interesting. And I love that she closed with a message to like all parents just to trust your instinct. Because I think,
yes,
especially after the pandemic, we hear so much stuff about the NHS being under so much pressure and, you know, you can't get an appointment. And sometimes you think, oh, I won't waste their time. But actually, if you think there is something wrong, that you are perfectly within your rights to knock down the door and say, no, I really need to be seen. This is not normal for me. This is not normal for my child. I certainly do it. I try and like put off and seeing the doctor as much as possible, but yeah. Really that yeah. is what they are there for.
Totally. And I really loved all the conversation around around chicken pox as well, because obviously, you know, we've just been through it and come out the other side. So I thought that was really fascinating. We actually get loads of messages on Made by Mamas. You guys are like, please put it in your highlights about what you did, because you don't know how bad it's going to be till you're in the middle of it. And actually all those kind of tips and tricks to know how to cope with it, they're super helpful. Yeah, I thought she was
and also
brilliant.
Just her advice on like the chickenpox vaccine as well, because there's so much chat around that and it's really difficult. And she's basically saying that she'll give you the facts. Actually, she said that on her Instagram that she sort of summarized the pros and the cons, and so you can go on there and make your own decision. Like, you can basically be like, can I afford to take 10 days off work? Is that going to be more beneficial to me? I think I probably will go away and maybe get Gigi vaccinated now. I think when she put it like that, 10 days off work, I thought, probably not. Probably that is definitely worth the £120.
How many people do you reckon after this podcast have been like Googling like, chickenpox vaccine,
when can I get it booked in?
10 days off work?
Yeah, I'm doing it before this episode goes out. Gigi's getting booked in this afternoon.
No, that was great. And I really hope you guys found it useful as well. Of course, we love doing these podcasts for you. And, you know, they're all there as well. So we've got a whole back catalogue, hundreds of episodes for you to go back and digest on various different subjects, always drop us a message and ask us if we've got a podcast on it, and we will send you in the right direction. And as always, we would love you to rate, review, subscribe, and please give the podcast a follow, and then you won't miss any episodes.
Yeah, please do. And if you have got any guests you'd like to hear from, topics you'd like to cover, like as Zoe said, our DMs are always open and we'll try and get back to you. We're on at Made by Mamas on Instagram, and we'll be back on Tuesday. Made by Mamas is an Insanity podcast production, and today's episode was produced by the lovely Charlotte Mason.
Insanity Group.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.